take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
Hey.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your Sandunguero hits of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica. All year. People have said, where is the Bad Bunny episode? Where is the Bad Bunny episode? Phenomenal question. There was a moment where we were going to do it. Didn't quite come together. Got distracted. Bad Bunny never went away. We're back. Bad Bunny episode, year end. We are going to get into not simply Un Verano Sin Ti, which is the biggest album of 2022 by just about any metric that any person has ever devised, and not simply the kind of capstone on the career thus far of Bad Bunny on his path to becoming the, I guess it's safe to say, the biggest star in global pop. But we're also going to talk about the history of Spanish language music in American pop. We are going to talk about the political climate in Puerto Rico and how that sets the tone for what Bad Bunny has been doing musically. We have two guests today. First, Leila Cobo from Billboard is going to come by, talk about the unprecedented nature of what Bad Bunny has achieved this year, and also all of the shoulders upon which he stands from the last 30, 40, 50 years for this moment to actually happen. And then later, Karina Del Valle-Shorsky, who profiled Bad Bunny for the magazine a couple of years ago, is going to come by and talk about that phase in his career, the burdens or non-burdens of representation, and growing into a political or politically savvy entertainer. So first, let's kick it off. Leila Cobo's here, calling in from Miami. If you are not familiar with Leila's work, Leila is the chief content officer for Latin music at Billboard, has been covering all your favorites for years and years and years, is the author of a book. It's called Decoding Despacito, an Oral History of Latin Music, that tackles a lot of what we are going to touch on today, and frankly has been the main observer documenting what's been happening for the last couple of decades, arriving at a moment like this. But let's do this. Let's start in this moment, and then we'll work our way backwards a little bit.
All right.
One of the hard things about working in music journalism these days, broadly speaking, is everything is treated as a superlative. The biggest, the best, the most poignant, the most important, da-da-da-da. And I think in that, you lose actual superlatives. Like, things don't mean what they used to mean. But I feel comfortable saying that the year that Bad Bunny has had is fundamentally unprecedented.
What I think is really cool or interesting about Bad Bunny is there is no precedent in Latin music, but there also is no precedent in music overall for many of the things he's achieved. Not for everything, but for many of the things. And so this truly sets him apart too, because, you know, you can qualify things in many ways. And here you do have the guy that has the most streams in Spotify, the most streams in Apple, the highest grossing tour in the world. There's a lot to say about him that has been superior to anyone else this year. And he's done it singing in Spanish, which I think is also the big differentiator.
We'll get into the sort of longer history of Spanish language pop and like crossover and whether that term even really has any meaning anymore or really ever had any true meaning. But what does it say about the state of reggaeton, that sound, that it can create the single biggest star on the planet? Like, for many, many years, I remember I was always having to argue with people and saying, y'all think that rock music is the central music of American culture, but it's not. It's hip hop. Like, it's weird to have this conversation. Now I feel like we're having the next conversation, which is it's not hip hop. Maybe it's this. Does it feel like Bad Bunny's success also represents a larger sea change in where the center of overall American popular music is.
I think for sure it represents that. I don't think this could have happened 10 years ago. Even if you had the same Bad Bunny with the same, I don't know, surrounding structure and the same sound and the same music and the same kind of persona that he is, I don't think he would have had the same success that he's had. Interestingly enough, last night we were at the Daddy Yankee show here in Miami. It's his grand finale, the last tour of his life, he says. And he really did start it. He took this rhythm that was, to my ears anyway, very Latin and very authentically Latin, because we also have rock in Espanol, but it's rock in Espanol. You know, it's not like we changed the fundamentals of the music, but reggaeton is a very distinctive beat. And it's been commercialized. It's a very easy beat to digest. It's very easy on the ear. And it's become massive. And Bad Bunny kind of rode that wave.
If we talk a little bit about the current Bad Bunny record, if we talk about Umbrella Sin-T, to my ears at least, it's maybe the most conventional, quote unquote, Bad Bunny record. One of the things that made him stand out so much in the, on the earlier albums is his willingness to push outside genre, to go in unconventional directions, a wide range of influences. There's something maybe a little victory lap-ish about this record of just, I'm the guy. Like, it's me. I'm on top. I'm just doing a quick trot around the stadium just to let everybody know that I'm here and I know that I'm on top. Even if it's maybe not my, to me, maybe my favorite or the best Bad Bunny record, there is something savvy about that, because what I feel like it's doing is it's holding on to people who have enjoyed Bad Bunny as someone who is potentially a provocateur, someone who is interested in spreading the boundaries of this sound, and also reaching out to people who are maybe more centrist and saying, yes, I have something for you too. Like, it's, we're all here in the same thing. How does this album strike you in the larger arc of his catalog?
It's a very broad album. I personally, like you, I have previous favorites. I love Yo Hago Lo Que Me Da La Gana, but this album has a couple of bangers that are great. I think Titi Me Preguntó is such a fun song. It's one listen and you're hooked. And I don't think he made it thinking, okay, I'm going to make a song that can be consumed by anyone in whatever they speak, but it works that way. It's like immediately just, what is it? Sticky. Sticky is the word. So he has several of these in this album, but he also manages, John, he always has this thing of he's able to put in a couple of songs that indicate depth and introspection and kind of analysis of what's happening in the world. Then he has like his perreo tracks, which are hardcore. Then he has the more commercial tracks. So I think he's very good at hitting all these spots versus just like delivering one kind of album. And I think that's part of his success too, which is why you go to his shows and there's all kinds of audiences in those shows. It's not just one demographic or one age group. And I think this album does that.
Layla, as someone who has interviewed Bad Bunny a bunch of times over the course of his career, from the very beginning to this most recent Billboard cover, which is comprised of two separate conversations that you had, I wonder if you can offer a little bit of perspective on how he perceives his evolution. How has he come to understand his role in music, in broader popular culture? How is the person from 5, 6, however many years ago compared to the person that you spoke to this year?
I started interviewing him when he was just beginning. In fact, they asked me to please put him in one of our reggaeton panels every year during Billboard Latin Music Week. We have I call it the urban panel or the reggaeton panel. I mean, depending what artists are in it. And it's a big group panel. And we bring in like 5, 6 artists and they talk about the urban movement, the Latin urban movement. And he went into that panel when he was just beginning. So I thought he was interesting. You don't know what's going to happen with artists at that stage. I mean, you like him or you don't, but you really don't know what's going to happen 3, 5, 10 years from that point. And what I did see then and what I saw in subsequent interviews was he was always very centered. He always knew that he was doing music that sounded different. He wasn't interested in what people had to say about him. He was very, I hate to use the word humble when I describe anyone because I feel it's such an overused word, but he never had this bragging thing that so many artists have, and especially so many urban artists. He just didn't have that. He was very matter of fact about what he was doing. He never said, I'm the best, the biggest, the richest, the car, the chains. That just wasn't him. And I find that that's still the same. But this time around, definitely he's very conscious of the fact that he's scaled these great heights. He's very conscious of the fact that he's possibly the biggest artist in the world. He knows that. Like, he's not trying to fake humble the thing. But I find that he hasn't become an asshole, frankly. I mean, he just isn't.
What a relief.
Yes.
I'm sure you've interviewed a bunch of assholes, as have I.
Well, I've interviewed people that they do change. It's hard not to change when you have the whole world looking at you and the people around them change too. And I don't think that that's what's happening here, or at least that's not how I perceive it. That's not how he's behaving with me, at least. But I do feel it's sincere. I think he still sees himself as the same person. Yes, he's done all these things, but it wasn't like he started his career and said, I'm going to be the biggest of all time. I genuinely don't think that that's what it was about. He says as much, and I believe him.
Do you think that his understanding of his place as a musical innovator, is that something that's perpetually on his mind? Because I was reading an older feature, an older interview with him, and it was maybe 2020, and I forget which album had just come out, but he basically, somewhere in the interview, he says something like, the next album, it's nothing like this album, which is a thing that like artists say a lot, as you know, and often they're just making it up. That's not real. But like, in fact, he was not making it up. He wasn't capping at all. Like, it was in fact a totally different kind of record. Do you think that he senses that there's a pressure or an expectation of him to be a musical innovator, not simply just a big superstar, a popular personality, but also someone on whose shoulders, like, the boundaries of the genre are resting?
I don't know if he would define it as he feels outside pressure, but I do think he feels like he needs to do something, maybe not so much different, but something that's really him. And I see that in his collaborations. In this album, he collaborates with The Marías, with Bomba Estéreo, with Buscabulla. Those three names in particular are more indie sounds. Well, Bomba Estéreo signed to Sony, but they're still fundamentally an indie band. The Marías are an indie group. You know, these are all kind of more niche, fringy artists. And he has the luxury of being able to say, you know what, I'm going to collaborate with these people because I like their music. I think they're cool. I like their sound. I can do it. I can pretty much do whatever I want to. And a lot of big artists don't do that. They collaborate with other big artists. And I love the fact that he's not doing that, that yeah, he's still collaborating with the people that he likes, like Jayco and Rauw Alejandro. Those are like his buddies. They're massive stars right now. But he also takes a detour and says, okay, I'm going to collaborate with people whose music I like, even if they have one follower. I don't care. And I do love that.
And I also appreciate that he's always reached out outside of the boundaries of whether it's Latin trap or reggaeton, doing a dembow record, like sampling a bachata song, doing a regional Mexican, you know, like a trap corrido record. I feel like for many, many years, I was always waiting for those boundaries to get dropped, to get lowered. But those scenes, I feel like, often weren't really talking to each other, certainly not on big records at all. It always felt like things were kept siloed off. And he seems completely uninterested in that.
He does. And I also think that what he's found is he started doing these unusual collaborations, let's call them, like what you said about Trap Corrido when he did that song with Natanael Cano. Which, by the way, what he did was that he heard Natanael, who was just beginning. Well, he was, I think, 17 years old at the time. He liked the song, and so he put it on his social media. And then what we found is that when he does that, people react to it. So instead of people being apathetic about it or neutral about it, they react very positively. And so I think that that's also emboldened him to say, hey, I can kind of like put my I don't know, my sound wherever I want, and people are going to like it or they're not going to like it, but no one's going to be indifferent to it. And I think that's very powerful because musicians are experimenting all day long and some things work and some things don't. And in his case, kind of everything seems to work. So if I were him, I would also be going kind of crazy doing doing crazy stuff.
Let's talk a little bit about the history. You mentioned Danny Yankee earlier, and obviously I remember the Gasolina moment like so vividly. I went back and looked at something I wrote around that time, and I think I wrote something to the effect of like, Daddy Yankee's basically going to spend the rest of his life trying to top Gasolina, like, which like not an insult at all. It's like, we should all be so lucky as to have a thing that we do that's so universally incredible that we spend the rest of our lives trying to top it. That's what I feel about every episode of Popcast.
Exactly.
That's exactly right.
Longevity. Exactly, longevity. That's right. That's what everyone aspires to.
We talking that talk today, but I remember that moment so vividly, but I also remember how hard it was for most people, a lot of people who I knew, to kind of get their heads around it and understand that it wasn't a classic one-hit wonder. This was a person who's like a legitimate huge star just in a parallel space who happened to have a moment of awareness outside of that scene, but there was nothing one hit about it, about either the sound, the style, or the artist. That wasn't that long ago. What is that? 06, maybe 05, something along those lines. Not that long ago where a huge hit like that was fundamentally an outlier proposition. Talk a little bit about the larger shifts that have happened since the Gasolina moment to allow for a Spanish language album to be the absolute biggest album in America and in a lot of ways on the planet. What's changed in the last 16 years, 17 years?
Oh my gosh, I think so many things have changed. And I think what has made it happen is that the changes have been musical, but they've also been demographics and they've also been cultural. It hasn't been just one thing. With Daddy Yankee, he took a genre that even for Latin music was a niche genre. They were doing that music in Puerto Rico and in Panama. And in Puerto Rico specifically, which is where the music exploded locally, it was club music. It was underground. The lyrics were not radio friendly. They were very explicit. So no one was really paying attention to this music. No one was looking at these artists on television. They were not listening to them in radio at a time when radio was everything. And then Daddy Yankee made the song, which was so commercial. And he made a great album. Gasolina is a track from Barrio Fino. Not even the single, but Barrio Fino is a fantastic album, I have to say. And Barrio Fino debuted at number one on Billboard's Top Latin Albums chart. And just like you, I remember this very clearly because when I got the chart, I thought, I cannot believe this guy is debuting at number one on this chart. And that, I think, was a major shift because it showed that there was this whole vast audience of people that were consuming this music. They were buying this record because back then you needed to buy the record to chart. And we just didn't even know about it. So it was, wait, there's a whole world of this out there and we don't know about it and we're Latins. And I think it just opened the door to the fact that Latin music was so much more than it was at the time. And reggaeton, like it or not, because a lot of people don't like it, but it has really opened huge doors and it's allowed other artists and other genres to flourish. But reggaeton has been a great equalizer. So I think it's been the music in the U.S. You have a growing Latin demographic. People are still speaking Spanish because this was another thing, John, that 15 years ago, I remember people would tell me, oh, Latins immigrate here and they forget their Spanish. They don't use it anymore. Second, third generations don't speak it anymore. And I find that that's changed. And second, third generations are really consuming the music that their parents consumed. So that's also shifted. And then you have streaming, and streaming really changes everything because you measure everything.
I want to touch on something that when we talked the other day, we were talking about the intergenerational challenges of certain scenes in Latin music and how really the reggaeton explosion of the mid to late 2000s and establishing like a firm footing for youth culture in Puerto Rican communities and in other Caribbean Latin diaspora communities. That helped to set a tone more broadly for younger artists in other Spanish-speaking communities, because we were talking a little bit about regional Mexican music and how really it's only in the last few years that there feels like a real youth wave in that scene. And that to me has always felt predicated upon what was built with reggaeton and how big that became and how important it was representationally for a young generation that was American but still mindful of heritage.
Yeah, I agree. I was telling you that when I grew up in Colombia, and there were no artists that were of my generation. All the music you heard belonged to older artists. There seemed to be like no one of your age. I think that's also why Shakira was such a hit when she came out. Shakira, suddenly you have this 18-year-old that looks like you, acts like you, sings about things that you're interested in. It was like, oh my God, wow. Oh my God, there's something for me out there. And I think Latin music really missed that for a long time. And with reggaeton especially, which is such a youth-oriented music, it really opened the door. Argentina is a great example. Argentina, which was long the land of rock and español, actually, now is the land of a whole urban rap reggaeton movement, very much of their own, very young, very diverse, lots of women. It's fascinating. And everybody, I would say, is between 17 and 23 years old. And they've become huge artists. Bizarrap is a great example. You know, this DJ who collaborates with all these different artists, and every song he releases becomes a viral hit.
Maybe now is a good time to look a little bit further back, like whether it's obviously we're talking about Gasolina, we can talk about the Despacito moment, Shakira, Ricky Martin. We've been around, both of us, we've been around long enough to understand that you, when a song like that has like an incredible crossover, again, in quote marks, or breakout, there tends to be this wave of media coverage about the coming Latin wave. Like it's always so redundant. It's so annoying. And it always feels predicated on the fact or predicated on the notion that there was nothing, like it's ahistorical, right? It's as if it's not reflective of an entire industry, scene, culture. And it suggests that it might recede, like a wave will come and then it will disappear. And I feel like that's always such a disingenuous way of covering really any music, but certainly music like this. You talk about this a lot in your book, but I wonder if you can give a little bit of historical perspective, especially for our younger listeners who may not remember like the Ricky Martin moment or whatever, right? Or the early Shakira stuff. Tell me about what were the actual challenges for Spanish language music coming across in the 90s, for example, or in the early 2000s. Like, what were the challenges that were present then and that served as like unclimbable walls that maybe are no longer there because of what we talked about before, streaming and demographics and whatnot?
Well, Spanish was the biggest challenge. I always thought the music wasn't Spanish. And because the music wasn't Spanish, it would never get played on mainstream radio. It was not going to get into late night television. Even when you went to a record store, there would be vast sections of everything. And then Latin would be like this tiny little wall there with, I don't know, 50 titles. The language was really an issue. And the language obeyed to the fact that you had a smaller group of people here in the U.S. specifically, I'm talking, who spoke Spanish. So you couldn't justify having the same space for them as for everything else. So Spanish was an issue, which is why all these big artists that we talk about now, like Ricky Martin, Shakira, Marc Anthony, they quote unquote crossed over. Crossing over meant they recorded in English so that they could be consumed by the mainstream. And Ricky Martin, this was 1999. And he was a huge star in Latin America, huge star. And Tommy Mottola took note of him, decided he was going to do something with him, had him sing the World Cup song, which was a big, big hit, and then got into a whole fight with the Grammys because he wanted Ricky Martin to perform at the Grammys. The Grammys didn't want Ricky Martin to perform at the Grammys. Tommy Mottola had to threaten a boycott. And then finally, they allowed him to perform The Cup of Life. And it was a sensation, but it was the first time that many people around the country heard of Ricky Martin, much less saw him or heard him. And that performance, which I urge anyone who hasn't seen it to look it up, it's somewhere on YouTube. That performance, I think, was the beginning of Latin music really having a presence in the world overall as a mainstream mass-consumed phenomenon.
As someone who was covering the music, when people were talking about these kind of crossover moments and saying it has an implicit ceiling on it, you knew that was bullshit, right? Like, you knew it was bullshit. Like, you
No, I didn't.
Come on. Really?
I didn't. John, I swear, like 15 years ago, I never thought something in Spanish would be number one on the Hot 100, on the Billboard Hot 100. That's her chart that measures every song. Every song that's released in this country is measured in that chart. I never thought it could be possible that a song in Spanish would be number one. It was just so hard. I couldn't see it happening. I always thought, oh, it's going to do well. It's not going to go anywhere. I mean, I would go to concerts. I knew it was there. I would go to arenas every weekend. They were packed. So the music was there. The artist was there. The audience was there. But I thought the language barrier was going to be too difficult to ever crack. When Despacito started to climb the charts, I cannot tell you, I was beside myself with joy. Every week I would look at that chart, I would be like, oh my God, this is so exciting. I can't believe it. Finally, we're seeing the light.
And even obviously the Despacito moment, it requires the Justin Bieber, the boost, the Bieber boost, as it were. But one of the things that I find odd about the language barrier argument, and have always found odd about that argument, is like, I listen to so much music on a daily basis, and I do not know what the person is saying. I listen to hip hop records where I don't know what the person is saying. I have a longstanding bit about not knowing anything that Bob Dylan is talking about, certainly not in the last 15 years of Bob Dylan recordings or 20 years. I don't know what that man is saying. I have no idea. So, like, if you could commit to enjoying Bob Dylan or, like, a particularly obscure Young Thug song, why would language be a barrier? That's the thing that I understand. Like, to me, music and enjoying music, sometimes it's about wordplay and sometimes it's about the specifics of language, but just as often it's about texture or mood or big picture structure or whatever. And I never really went in for the language barrier argument. Maybe I'm an outlier in that regard.
I believe the language barrier was a real thing. One thing I've often said in interviews when people ask me, oh, did you have a hard time being a woman in the Latin music industry? Was this a big barrier for you? And I always say, no, my big barrier is I have an accent. And even though it's not a huge accent, but I have one, people can tell I'm not from here. And I think that turns a lot of people off. I think if it were a British accent, that would be better. But it isn't.
It turned off for me personally, but I know what you mean.
I really think some people hear an accent and they immediately think, oh, she's less than, she's not going to be as good, as smart, as whatever. I think the language was a problem. I don't think it is anymore, but I love to hear that for you. It wasn't. And you're right. I don't understand half of what Bob Dylan is saying either.
Big talk. That's right.
But, you know, like Justin Bieber singing on Despacito, that was huge. You know how a lot of people criticize him because they said, oh, his accent is horrible. Like, he messed up the words. I thought, are you kidding me? It's Justin Bieber. At that point, he was the biggest music star in the world. And he's making an effort. He likes the song. He learned the lyrics in Spanish. He's trying to do something. That, I think, was also super important because it told a lot of the world and a lot of his fans, hey, it's cool to listen to music in another language and to learn the words in another language. And what I find now is that listeners, they don't care if it's in another language. But I think a generation ago, a lot of people did care. I don't think they do anymore. And one thing, John, that we haven't spoken about, but I also think is really important, is when streaming became the way that you listen to music, that was also very favorable for music in Spanish, because you have music in Spanish being done in, I forget the exact number of countries, but it's, I believe there's a little over 20 countries that speak Spanish, and they really love music. People always use this as a cliche. Oh, Latins love music. Latins actually do love music. Like the IFPI has done all these studies, and they consume more music per capita than other countries. So this is a fact. And then when you aggregate that in streaming, it's a lot of people. So if you have Bizarrap having success in Argentina and then in Peru and then in Colombia and then in Spain, it aggregates and suddenly you see these names popping up in your global charts and you're like, oh, who is this person? And it happens a lot with music in Spanish more than with other languages.
Look, even with everything we're talking about all the demographic shifts and the streaming and the direct, the overall trending direction of all music consumption, it's still hard not to say Bad Bunny is a one of one. Because, right? Because he does feel a little bit like a one of one. And this is where the superlatives thing that I was mentioning earlier really comes in, because I do wonder how long it will take for another person to do what he's done. What is 2023, 24, 25 look like? Not for Bad Bunny per se, but the success of Bad Bunny, what he's been able to achieve. What doors does that open now? Because you were saying you couldn't even fathom in the Gasolina moment, or maybe even the Despacito moment, that something like this could happen. All Spanish language album, the number one album in the country, the number one artist in the country and potentially on the planet. Okay, well, that's done now. We did it. So that happened. Okay. So now what? What's next?
Well, first of all, I do agree with you that he's a one of one. I think this is a very unique artist. I think replicating him it's just going to be very difficult. And if I was able to put my finger on it and tell you, this is why it worked, this is why it worked, I don't know what it is. There's a lot of things going on, but I feel like he's floated above everything. He's at that stage in his career where everything he does works. The guy wants to do wrestling, and so he wrestles, and it's a hit. He wants to do movies, and so he's in Bullet Train, and it's a hit. He could do anything, and I think people would embrace it. So he's just a very unique artist. What he did with the tour, he did an arena tour, and then two months later, he says, okay, now I'm doing a stadium tour, and he sells it all out. These are really difficult things to do.
Who's going to follow in his footsteps? Or maybe the question is, what is the barrier that can be broken next?
I don't know that we can say, oh, this is the next Bad Bunny. More than that, what I think, though, is that there's a very solid Latin music movement happening right now. So even if there's not another Bad Bunny, there are many artists that are making the boats float. And maybe there's not going to be another artist that's going to do these kinds of ticket sales next year or the following, but there is going to be more and more music being consumed by the movement as a whole. And I think that's the best thing that could happen, because it can't all fall on the shoulders of one person. You need a movement, or else things wane. And I think we have a movement, and I think the artists are trying to make better music. There's more music. There's people are helping other people, and all this keeps things alive. I think pre-pandemic, maybe you would see four good arena tours in the U.S. by Latin artists. Now you have dozens. Like I said, the Yankee tour, that was a great tour. I don't think Yankee has done an arena tour in years. So all these things, it's not just Bad Bunny. Bad Bunny, what he's done is he has really helped solidify a movement. And he's allowed a lot of people around the world to say, okay, there's this guy, what else is there? And that's important. And now it's in the hands of the artist to say, okay, I'm going to deliver things that are quality, that are going to keep people listening. I can't like deliver crap. I got to try and make good music to keep this going.
The potential upside is actually bigger than anyone really could have anticipated. So people need to be ready to rise to the occasion.
I think so, John. And you hear things that are really, I'm not going to compare with Bad Bunny, but an artist like Silvana Estrada, who just won the Grammy, the Latin Grammy for Best New Artist, she does this very soulful singer-songwriter music. She plays her small cuatro. She sings these heartfelt songs. And she's very successful in her lane. And I don't know that Silvana Estrada could have worked 5 years ago. She signed to an American label and they've really nurtured her, taken care of her, and she's doing very well and she's found her audience. Is this the result of Bad Bunny? No, I'm not saying that. But I do think it's the result of people saying there's an audience for Latin music. Let's see what else we can give him. And it's not all reggaeton. There's all kinds of stuff that we can give him. That's great. That's good. That's different. We can take risks. We can go to town with this music.
Leila Cobo, a privilege and a joy to have you. And I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Karina. Let's listen to that Bad Bunny song with Bomba Estéreo. This is Ojitos Lindos.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made. Or how a wooden table is built, piece by piece. And in not-so-small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
We're back. Part two, Bad Bunny year-end episode. We were just with Leila Cobo. We are back. It's Karina Del Valle-Shorsky. Karina.
Nailed it. Nailed the pronunciation. I'm impressed. I didn't give him a spelling guide, so he just said he could do it, and he did it.
Nothing but net. What can I say? Karina is a contributing writer at the Times Magazine, and you may remember Karina's profile of Bad Bunny from 2020. Karina also has a book coming out. She just finished her PhD, a thing that I never did. So shout out to you. And has a book coming out next year called The Other Island. Karina is also wearing Bad Bunny merch. I am wearing Bad Bunny merch. Tell us about your Bad Bunny merch and then I will tell you about mine.
Yes, it's my second item of Bad Bunny merch, but the only one I have now. And it's from the latest tour. It's Un Verano Sin Ti merch. It's really the back.
Oh, the back that's cool. That's popping.
It's really beautiful, kind of like, you know, millennial surfer kind of aesthetics. It's a nice fit. And I got it, of course, at the Yankee Stadium concert. I had to do it.
It's giving pack sun. No shots, yeah. But it's giving back sun. So how old am I? Sometimes people wonder, how old am I? I am old enough to remember when there was no good Bad Bunny merch. That's how old I am.
Crazy.
I went to the show, the first show at the United Palace Theater, I think it was, in like 2016, 17, 18. Who can remember? Time is a construct. But I remember there was a t-shirt at that show and I thought it was really not up to par for an artist who was that good. And so I didn't end up getting one. And then I regretted not getting one because I like to have as early a merch item from an artist as I can.
From a historical perspective.
Yeah, for the archive. Imagine if you see the bookshelf behind me, imagine what the archive of the t-shirts is like. And so this is maybe the first Hot Topic Bad Bunny t-shirt from, I want to say 18 or 19, which obviously when I saw, had to make sure was part of the collection.
I mean, that's really the endurance of millennial culture that Bad Bunny is really tapped into. But the fact that Hot Topic, you can still go to Hot Topic and buy a t-shirt, you know, I mean, that's like the last living mall in America, you know, is Hot Topic itself.
I have no happier place Nothing I love to do more than go to Hot Topic and look at NBA Youngboy t-shirts. Truly, nothing I like more. Karina, when you interviewed Bad Bunny, we talked about this a little bit in prep for this, but the thing that is most fascinating about that moment in time is that none of what happened this year in 2022 was a given. Obviously, there's no person more important than Bad Bunny in like global popular music, period. Every person knows that. We did not know that in 2020.
Well, he was already the number one most streamed artist on Spotify. So I think that's something to remember, that the kind of supernova of this year, like, was built over it quickly, but it was built. And I feel like at that time, I mean, historians hate the idea of inevitability, and I think nothing is inevitable, but I felt when I was with him the momentum of where this could go, even if I wouldn't have anticipated all the details. And part of the reason that's the case, to my mind, isn't just about Bad Bunny and like his music and his career, but is also about the symbiotic relationship that career has had with the political momentum and crisis in Puerto Rico. And so because that also was so inevitable or had so much momentum, seeing those two things together and spending time with him made me think it's going to keep going.
Talk a little bit about that, because there's a really good stretch in your piece where you kind of almost break down year for year, project for project, the link between the two. For listeners, especially who may not be completely aware of the political situation in Puerto Rico over the last like 5 or 6 years, talk a little bit about what's been happening and how his career has represented and also woven through that.
I think that it's complicated history, and a lot of times the US media doesn't want people to know about it. So it's not surprising that people are not caught up. But in 2016, I sort of started in 2016, that Soy Peor, like Bad Bunny's first major single, a kind of like sad boy trap. I still love it, actually. But that year was the passage of a bill called Promesa, which was passed by Obama. And it was Puerto Rico's debt restructuring bill. But the thing about it is that it basically installed a direct colonial government in Puerto Rico, a 7-person appointed board that Puerto Ricans often call La Junta. And they are in charge of the budget of Puerto Rico. So immediately major austerity was implemented. And it's like tons of schools shut down. The public utility, electric utility was sold. All this stuff happened where basically, just as everybody else is also dealing with like economic crashes, like Puerto Ricans are really like plunged into like a bare bones impoverished situation. And then, of course, that's the beginning of Bad Bunny's career. He's that generation facing that reality that people under 25, which he was, had the minimum wage was lowered to below $5 an hour. And this is on an island where everything's expensive. So it's a sense of real social unrest. And then Hurricane Maria hits in 2017. And we saw what a fiasco that was and the level of abandonment. Puerto Rico has not recovered. And Bad Bunny is out here with Estamos Bien, which really became also, it's also basically a sad boy trap song, but it's a sad boy trap song that's implicitly about the hurricane and about the demand that Puerto Ricans, Puerto Rico se levanta, that Puerto Ricans pull themselves up by their bootstraps and are survivors. And he's like, ironizing that and saying no. So there's that, then that song becomes this whole political anthem. Meanwhile, he's having all these features and all these verses and all these collaborations. So that's 2017. 2018, he puts his album out. And then 2019, so 2 years later, you have these massive uprisings when the governor of Puerto Rico had these chats of his leak with other government officials, which revealed total disdain for the people of Puerto Rico. There was incredible corruption in the allocation of hurricane funds. They made fun of the debt, the people who had died in Puerto Rico after the hurricane. And there was a massive uprising. And the people of Puerto Rico, like I'm saying it in Spanish, votamos a Ricky Rosselló. And Bad Bunny was in the street, you know, it was his first street protest. So he's riding this whole wave. And then it's basically been, you know, Hurricane Fiona this year. And since 2019, it's been kind of a nonstop escalation of the level of austerity, settler colonialism from the U.S., where there are all these tax breaks that are given to U.S. property owners in Puerto Rico. And people are really suffering and people are really rising up and flexing their our power. So Bad Bunny is both being buoyed up by that in an inevitable way, but also cultivating a real dialogue. And then for us, us meaning Puerto Ricans, wherever we live, and also us, I think Latinos in general, to some extent, that's been the soundtrack of these events. So the music has imprinted emotionally on this period in a way that gives it tremendous power. And I think these have been years of uprising and global tumult across the world. I think that's part of the resonance that Bad Bunny has, even though his particular fight is Puerto Rican.
One thing that comes up in your piece is it feels like he is in a moment of just beginning to understand what the expectations of others of him are or could be. And I mean that not simply musically or via entertainment, but politically, in terms of what he's willing to speak up about, how he's willing to speak up, being an activist or at least nodding towards activism, being truly a representative for Puerto Rican people in the global conversation. Tell me a little bit about what he talked to you about coming to terms with that responsibility and wanting to either lean into it or maybe even being a little overwhelmed, but trying to find a voice within. How was that in his mind at that time?
It was a super interesting moment because it was the pandemic. It was August 2020, and he was taking a break and living back in Puerto Rico for the first time since he got famous. So he was back from his first world tour for Por Siempre, and he kind of locked down. He shut down his social media. He was in a very reflective mode, and he said to me, I asked kind of a provocative question, but I wanted to know what he thought. Like, when did you realize Puerto Rico was a colony? I knew that that question would resonate with him. I wasn't that nervous about framing it in that way. But he said it was coming back to Puerto Rico after seeing all these other parts of the world, especially Latin America, and them saying, you know, having these really derisive views of Puerto Rico as like a colony, one of several of the United States. And also beginning to ask questions. He was so young when he got famous. I think it was 23 or something like that. So what I saw happening was both him processing what he had realized about Puerto Rico on coming back to it, and also processing his fame, of course, and also just being quite young and at a moment of a kind of like adult reckoning. And what I really appreciated about him in person, and that I appreciate overall, is that he is willing to think out loud and he's willing to make mistakes. And that's so key. And then, of course, once he does so, he's willing to learn and change his behavior based on that. So I felt like that's what I was kind of watching him. We talked for some number of hours, like it was 6 hours total, and his friends were there. And so it was kind of a discussion. And they were having actual discussions in front of me about, you know, how the hurricane had changed their sense of like Puerto Rican society, like what the meaning of this generation is. They were in it and willing to like talk about it directly. I hadn't actually interviewed any like real celebrity before, so I don't know what's common, but I was a little bit like pleasantly like surprised. And then I think he was feeling resistant to the idea that he would have to have an opinion about every issue that was right the first time.
And that's powerful because I feel like in the kind of contemporary celebrity journalism environment, I think there is this struggle where famous people are expected to have the correct opinion about a social issue, or perhaps are encouraged not to express an opinion at all. And that is so not true to how people's opinions and politics develop just on a pure level. It's not true. And oftentimes, if you got famous and you got famous young, you maybe were not exposed to the type of progressive thinking or any thinking that would prepare you to answer questions along those lines. And no one on your team or no one in your crew is like, here's the right way to talk about this. I, for one, am always grateful when someone steps up and says, I will answer this, but I may not be right or I may feel different a year from now or 2 years from now. And it seems like that was his perspective. That's how he felt. He felt that he knew and wanted to participate, but maybe it wasn't 100% certain how he could best be of service at that moment.
Absolutely. And I think that the growth that we've seen in his capacity to talk about the political issues he cares about in a like detailed and fearless way has definitely been developed a lot more strongly in the last 2 years. That probably reflects, you know, study and experience, as well as I think it's not an accident that the issues that Bad Bunny has been most vocal about are the issues, again, like pertaining to Puerto Rico and the general crisis, because it's also true that the collective discourse has sharpened in the last couple of years. Again, like that kind of like mutually reinforcing thing. Something that I've really liked to see is that, for example, when he made the song Yo Perreo Sola and was beginning to speak out against transphobia and stuff like that, honoring the death of a trans woman in Puerto Rico, Alexa Luciano, all that, people were like, okay, Yo Perreo Sola, but first of all, why is this song so similar to Yo Quiero Bailar by Ivy Queen? And like, where are the women? Why do you never collab with women? What's up with that? And like, A, he made a remix of the song with Ivy Queen and he brings her on tour now at different appearances. And then it's like his most recent Telemundo concert, the huge streamed concert for this album. It's like Viano Antiano, the like hottest, most amazing rapper in Puerto Rico right now, who's a trans woman, huge audience of millions, and two other young queer women artists in Puerto Rico. So he like heard that and adjusted his behaviors. And it feels like it's not just optics, because it really is putting people on to really important, amazing artists, figures in this landscape that people aren't necessarily already paying attention to. So I like to see it.
And also, I feel like being open-eared and by extension, open-hearted is kind of baked into the Bad Bunny proposition in terms of the range of his collaborations. I wouldn't say that of 4 out of 5 major pop stars, you know, regardless of genre. Like, I just think that a lot of people are very cloistered, but he is not a person who is cloistered. Do you want to talk a little bit about El Apagón and that video?
Yeah. Also just about the song, because it's kind of an interesting bomba EDM mashup. And like, I think no matter like how much you like Bad Bunny's music, he's known for his kind of like dramatic mid-song transitions, like genre transitions, whether it's the bachata to dembow transition in La Romana or, you know, in Al Apagón, this kind of mashup. There are so many actually examples of this song. Of this in his songs, like Garo, Safaera is sort of the ultimate example of all that. But El Apagón starts out as a bomba rhythm, him rapping over a bomba rhythm. And bomba is the oldest music, post-colonial music in Puerto Rico. So before salsa, before anything else, the first one is bomba. And it's an Afro-Puerto Rican music that has a really deep sense of ceremony and of protest. So it's basically like bomba is the sort of like fundamental protest music of Puerto Rico. You see it at protests too, but it's again, that African basis of all this music. But Puerto Ricans will recognize the drums as like, okay, this is a ceremonial and perhaps even like song of revolt that we're hearing already. And then he's bringing these kind of like cheeky raps over it about like the power of Puerto Rico. And a line that he says in it, careful with my crew, because there's a ton of us, is like, I always think of that when I think of Bad Bunny's. It's a good description of like Bad Bunny's power, even though it's a small island, just his sense that he's bringing a lot of people with him. So you have that in El Apagón. It starts that way. There's a lot of like funny bars in it. And then it switches to this EDM beat. And we get, I don't know if I can say these words, maybe because they're Spanish swear words, it's okay. I'm going to go for it. You know, me gusta la chocha de Puerto Rico. Or something like Puerto Rico está cabrón, like these phrases, these refrains, if you will, that are on the one hand, like super super just taken from the rhetoric of Urbano, but at the same time set against this EDM house beat that brings in a queer energy. And in the video, indeed, there's voguing when it's a queer scene in the video when it visualizes this part of the song. But there's something very exciting and very thrilling about being able to like sing that at the top of your lungs in some of the environments where Bad Bunny's music plays, for me most recently at the Whitney Museum.
where it belongs, obviously.
Where it belongs. So that's El Apagón, and it's named The Blackout. That's the name of the song. And it's addressing this pattern of blackouts in Puerto Rico that have only increased exponentially since the U.S. sold Puerto Rico's public power grid to LUMA. But at the same time, it's also the sense of this incredibly celebratory energy that has always been part of how Caribbean people process, you know, the trauma of living in that region. He dropped the video just before Hurricane Fiona hit, and he said on his Instagram, "I hope the lights last long enough for you to watch the video." El Apagón. And in the middle of it, what does Bad Bunny do? It doesn't, like, in my view, it doesn't totally work, but it's like, it's still worth it that he did it, I think. And it's, she's an amazing journalist, whatever. He dropped a 20-minute documentary in the middle.
Right, of the music video.
Of the music video, to clarify. So it starts like a normal music video, you know, and then it's like, dropping in the middle, like one of his rhythm cuts that you're not expecting. And the amazing independent journalist, Bianca Gralau, who many of us have been following on Instagram for forever, or however long she's been doing it. It's her doing a literal documentary about the privatization of the electric grid and about U.S. settler colonialism in Puerto Rico, driving people out and making it unaffordable. He's definitely out here trying things and being like as vocal really as he possibly can be from his position about the crisis going on. My friend is a poet, Raquel Salas Rivera, and Raquel always calls this period La Bella Crisis, like the beautiful crisis. And it's a Bad Bunny-like term, you know? We have to invent new words for this time.
I've been out of the academy for a long time. Do people still talk with a framework of organic intellectuals, or is that some 90s, early aughts energy?
Bad Bunny is an organic intellectual. I think that, for example, Cardi B is a more sophisticated political thinker than Bad Bunny. I think she reads more and consumes more news. I think that she just has maybe a greater gift for analysis than he does. And I think she's not given the credit for that, partly because of misogynoir and other issues, classism, urbanism, all these different things. I mean, I don't even think like being an intellectual is Bad Bunny's main thing, but he is an organic political figure for sure.
Before we go, I'm going to make you tell the story that you told me on the phone the other day. I'm not going to tip my hand. You just talk us through a special moment that you had with Bad Bunny.
There were so many special moments, okay, where, yeah, to begin in our special friendship that we had.
Okay.
There are so many ways to, you know, glean knowledge, and Bad Bunny has amazing taste in music. He listens very widely. He's a very curious person. He's very smart. But he did tell me that he does not read, period, which, you know, on a certain level, I respect. I respect not reading the criticism about you if you're an artist, even though I wish they would.
Well, be careful what you wish for.
You're right. You're absolutely right. Take it back. Anyway, so he's like, yeah, I don't read. Okay, so it's, you know, the end of the day, it's hours later. We're finally all leaving his manager's house, and Bad Bunny had gone to the bathroom, and he came out to say goodbye to everybody, and he was holding a book. And I was like, Benito, you told me that you don't read. What's this? And of course, he holds it up, and it is a book of sex positions.
Ba-dum-bum.
But, you know, I mean, he's got to study up for his lyrics and to keep it fresh for us.
Truly, what more can you say? Karina, I appreciate you coming on and regaling us with the Bad Bunny backstory. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much, John.
That is our show. We've just been talking for more than an hour about Bad Bunny, and I honestly feel like we barely scratched the surface. I'm sure we'll be revisiting him in the coming months. There will be no shortage. I promise. You have my word. No shortage of Bad Bunny content moving forward. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. You can get t-shirts. It's the podcast.myshopify.com. Get in the Facebook group. Get in the Discord. That's tinyurl.com/podcastfacebook or /podcastdiscord. And subscribe to Popcast anywhere you get your audio content. Likely where you also get your Bad Bunny content. It's Apple. It's Spotify. It's all the other places. Our producer is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. Welcome to 2023 with us. We're going to carry you through another year. Let's go out with just that OG Bad Bunny, that 1.0 stuff. This is Soy Peor.
tirando billetes adentro el putero. Pa'l carajo el amor verdadero, yo solo pienso en hacer dinero. Baby, lo nuestro ya descansa en paz. Me importa un carajo con quién te vas. Dile a tu mic que ya no me hace falta. Cara tengo, se grate más. Tengo la blanquita que me hace la dance, la rockerita que se lo meto.